All right. Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. Am I on? Check, check, check. Hey there. It's good to see everybody. Welcome on President's Day weekend. We have donuts because you didn't go on vacation. So you're welcome. It's good to see all of you. My name is Ryan Brown. I'm the pastor of discipleship here. And we're starting a new series today. Over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be talking a lot about really your vocation, but thinking about vocation in the broadest sense of the term, whether that's paid or unpaid. It's what you do with most of your life. So where are you when you're not here? And that's kind of what we're thinking about. We're thinking about how does the gospel matter, not just on Sunday when you're sitting in here or in there or in a discipleship group or whatever it is. One of the places that God most shapes us is in our vocation. Discipleship means following Christ. And you follow Christ wherever you are, not just in this building. And so one of the ways that he forms us more and more into his image is the places that he sends us. The places that we spend the majority of our time. If I think about my own discipleship group over the past several years, I've had several different guys in and out over the past 8 or 9 years. If they're bringing something to the table that they want to talk about, almost 90% of the time, I can tell you it's either going to be something about their family or something about their work. Because their home and their office are where they spend most of their waking hours, right? And so we want to think about what does it look like to bring your Sunday equipping into Monday? Whatever that looks like. So over the next few weeks, that's what we're going to be focusing on. So we're calling it Gospel in the Ordinary because a lot of times we can create this maybe intentional, maybe unintentional distinction between the stuff we do on Sunday as sacred and the stuff we do on Monday as secular. But I don't think God designed our lives that way. I think he designed our lives to all be lived out before him. So there's an old Latin term, and I don't speak Latin, so I don't prefer to use the term, but it's called Coram Deo, but it means life before the face of God. That means we understand every waking hour and sleeping hour as before God. We don't leave him when we leave church. He is ever present. He's with us always. So a couple of verses that just, they're basic. You've heard them, but I just want to remind you. 1 Corinthians 10:31. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. I don't think that leaves stuff out. Whatever you do. I think that covers literally whatever you do. And we do it all to the glory of God. Colossians 3:23-24. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord, not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. So whatever kind of work you do, wherever you do that work, you are doing it ultimately for him. So your employer is not your ultimate employer. He is. So the work we do, wherever it is, it's work done for the Lord. Again, whether you're paid or unpaid for it. I love this. This is from Dan Doriani. He says it this way. Through our work, we become the hands of God. When people pray for their daily bread, God grants it through farmers, bakers, and grocers. When we pray for clothing and shelter, he sends shepherds and construction workers. We are often like the stage crew for a play. Our labor is sometimes invisible, but without it, the show would not go on. So a lot can be said over these next 4 weeks. One of the big challenges is going to be reducing it to just a few things. But as we jump into this, I want to go over a few assumptions we have. But before we do that, I just want to pray for us. Heavenly Father, as we think about what you've called us to as your people in the world, would you give wisdom? Would you give insight? Would you give understanding? And Lord, would you be near to us? I pray that we wouldn't walk out of here with just some ideas of what to do, but that we would genuinely feel your nearness and know that you have called us. Lord, meet with us. Let the words of our mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So I'm going to go over a few assumptions as we talk a little bit about where God has called us. Number one, work is a human activity that was given to man before the fall. So if you read through Genesis 1 and 2, man and woman are given tasks. We're going to talk more specifically about that in 2 weeks. But work existed before the fall happened. Work is not a sinful result of a broken world. Work is part of God's design for humanity. That brings to the second one. Well, let me just say this. Jesus, when he came to the earth, he worked. He was a carpenter, which may have meant and probably did mean he was a stonemason. Jesus did what we would consider today blue-collar work before he transitioned into a role of a rabbi. He dignified manual labor by actually taking it on himself. He did work. Did you know that 48 of the 52 parables that Jesus told require some awareness of somebody's work? That's only four of them that he told. He understood the deep value of work for people. To understand deep truths about who he is and the way that the kingdom works in the world, he used the avenue that people spend most of their waking hours to help teach us. So it's important to Jesus. But work is affected by the fall. In Genesis 3, work is specifically called out as cursed as a result of the fall. Rather than being fruitful, it becomes toilsome. So when you hear, we don't think typically in agricultural terms, but most of the Bible is written in agricultural terms. And so we hear the language of fruitfulness, right? You know, everything doesn't yield 100-fold in the harvest anymore. There can be drought, there can be famine, there can be pestilence and diseased plants, all that kind of stuff. That's part of the curse. Those stupid thorns that are growing up in my bushes in my backyard, I cannot kill them. That's part of the curse. Our work is cursed. We're still called to it. We're still designed for it, but it's hard. And there's going to be stuff that we have to push against the fall in our work. For example, a paramedic, they wouldn't have a job before the fall because people didn't break arms or worse. Some of our work pushes against the fall. Some of it pushes kingdom flourishing farther ahead. But all that said, the fall is significant. Because of that, though, not all work is good work. There are entire industries that are absolutely corrupted. It is work to put up a pornographic website. It's horrific work. It exploits people. It promotes trafficking of people, of humans. To take it even farther, let's think maybe somebody works at Visa their whole career. Working for Visa might not be bad, but maybe you're an account manager for pornographic websites. And so you could say it's fine to work at Visa, but it might not be fine to work in a certain department. So we've got to be thinking, how does our work either push against the fall or push the fall's effects forward? We're not going into a full-blown ethics discussion today, but it's worth thinking about. The fall has tremendous effects on the way that we do our work and the type of work that is done. Another assumption, our work is often culturally specific, and our ideas are deeply influenced by systems that we live in. The Bible was not written in the context of a free market economy. Right? So a lot of the illustrations in the Bible about work, we might read stuff into it based on what Adam Smith wrote in Wealth of Nations. That wasn't the assumption when Rome was in power, right? That probably was not a free market capitalistic society. There are plenty of places in the world that are not in a free market system, right? So when we're coming to this, we've got to understand that we have assumptions about the way economies work, whether we failed Econ 101 or not. We still just, it's the air we breathe, it's the water we swim in. So we've got to, from time to time when we're reading scripture, think, this was written over thousands of years with different nations in power and different economic systems each time. So all that said, we've got to be aware of our assumptions. There's times that we're going to realize that maybe our free market assumptions aren't necessarily in a certain specific application in line with the Word of God. So God's heart for the poor and marginalized is written to the law in such a way that sometimes God's people are called to sacrifice profit margin, financial security to serve the least and the lost. That doesn't fit with the book Wealth of Nations, right? So there are certain aspects of our economic assumptions that we're going to have to realize, okay, I've got to let the word trump my assumptions. All right. Again, I said we can't get through a lot of these, but one other thought too with that. Monetary assignment is how we value work. So you get paid a lot, that means your work must be important, right? That's how we naturally assume things. That's not necessarily the case in God's economy, right? So the assignment of wealth and how it's distributed, if you were, a thousand years ago or a few hundred years ago, if you were big and strong and didn't have bad eyesight, you got paid more. Now you can be like me and have horribly, horribly terrible eyesight and a bad back and sit in front of a computer all day and do okay, right? So these things shift as culture shift. Right, what gets monetary value does not necessarily equate to how God sees something. So, raising children is very difficult. I put it in the category of work. Right, just for example, I know of a mom who this morning had to pull a dirty pull-up out of a toilet that got flushed down. Not that it hits close to home or anything, but that's how the morning starts, and it's going to end with something probably similar tonight at about 8 o'clock, and it doesn't stop all day. That's work, right? I love this. This is Joanne, the wife of Tony Campolo. This is how he describes her work. Socializing two Homo sapiens into the dominant values of the Judeo-Christian tradition so that they can become the eschatological change agents God has assigned them to be for all of eternity. It's just job description for mom right there. But the reality is, a lot of the stuff we do that gets no payment is incredibly valuable work, and if that didn't happen, the world wouldn't keep going. All right, so just one more assumption here. Good work, it serves God and neighbor. Good work always serves God and neighbor. Back to Dan Doriani, he says it this way. First, no honest calling is morally superior to any other. Kind of what we were just talking about. Cashiers and corporate leaders, cabinet makers and ice makers, all have a capacity to serve God and neighbor. He will ask each of us the same questions on the last day. Did you honor me by honing the skills I gave you? Did you honor the parents, mentors, and friends who invested in you? Did you use your abilities to provide for your family? Did you promote the good of your neighbors, mankind, and this world? Did my people get answers to their legitimate prayers through you? These questions do not necessarily preclude evaluating various lines of work. The five questions assume that valid work serves society. Sadly, some work that is legal is useless or destructive. I put that quote on your page there because I love those questions. I think they're just helpful to consider. But thinking about how does our work actually serve people is incredibly important. So where we're going in this series, we're going to think about today calling and what does it look like to be called by God. Provision, what does it look like to be a provider for others? That'll be next week. And then we'll think about stewardship, not just financial stewardship, but the stewardship of where God has you. You have relationships wherever you are, and how do you steward those for kingdom purposes? And then the last week, we're going to talk about blessing. How does the work you do bring blessing to the world? The outcome of all these 4 weeks for many will probably just be a starting point to really begin thinking carefully about the work that we have. There is so much literature. I think I put some books up. Is that the next one? They're on the website, but these are several books that I'd recommend if you want to take a deeper dive. You don't need to read any of these for this class, but I think they're just helpful to have in mind. So as we get started, I'm going to do a quick, just a five-minute table discussion. First question, when people ask you, what do you do for work, how do you answer that right now? Some of you may be retired, some of you may be mid-career, some of you may be at home, whatever it is, or between jobs. But how would you answer that question right now? And then what is the job you've done for the longest? And that doesn't necessarily mean it's something you got paid for. All right, so table discussion on that. Ready, set, go. All right, I'm going to go ahead and interrupt. I'm going to interrupt your discussion for just a second, and then we're going to go back to discussion. So give me just a second if I can. All right, here's where we're going. We're going to think about the question of calling. And so this is a question I want you to think about. Don't say to anybody at your table, okay, because I don't want to accidentally undermine you later. So just think about it. What would you say is your true calling in life? Think about it for a second. All right, so hold on to that. And we're going to spend most of the day looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 17 through 24. I think I put it on the handout, but it'll also be up here. So I'm going to read it, and then we're going to discuss it at our tables a little bit, okay? It says this, "Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. Was anyone at the time of his call already circumcised? Let him not seek to remove the marks of circumcision. Was anyone at the time of his call uncircumcised? Let him not seek circumcision, for neither circumcision counts for anything nor uncircumcision, but keeping the commandments of God. Each one should remain in the condition in which he was called. Were you a bondservant when called? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can gain your freedom, avail yourself of the opportunity. For he who was called in the Lord as a bondservant is a freedman of the Lord. Likewise, he who is free when called is a bondservant of Christ. You were bought at a price. Do not become bondservants of men. So, brothers, in whatever condition each was called, let him there remain with God." So here's what I want us to do. At your table, give your internal processors a chance, okay? So maybe we'll start by thinking about this silently for a few minutes. And then you can discuss as a table. But I want you to think through these questions. What do you think verse 17 means when it says, lead the life that the Lord has assigned? And then, how would you define calling according to this passage? That word is used a lot of times. So what do you think this passage means when it says calling? All right, so think about it a little bit on your own. And then I'll either start the table discussion or it will start naturally when the extroverts can't handle it anymore. All right, ready, go. All right, I'm going to interrupt your discussion. I know there's a lot to be thinking about. And as usual, some of you can't believe I cut you off, and some are like, thank the Lord, we can stop. So with that said, I just want to take kind of three major points from that passage. This passage has so much in it. It's absolutely loaded. But I want to think about assignment, calling, and that little phrase, avail yourself. And we're going to go through this quick, but I want to start by deconstructing some of our, I'll just say, Western assumptions about career and the trajectory of life. So we have the American dream, and we've got movies, and those things shape the way we think about life. And there's a book written a little while ago. What was it called? So Good They Can't Ignore You is the name of the book. And he deals with something that he calls the passion hypothesis. And he says this, "The key to occupational happiness is to first figure out what you're passionate about and then find a job that matches this passion." And his entire goal in the book is to completely destroy that. He takes the hypothesis and says, this does not work in real life. And then he dismantles it. If you've heard of the 10,000 hours paradigm, right? You do something for 10,000 hours, you become an expert at it. This book is based on that 10,000 hour paradigm. Now, I can't get into it. I love to think about these two different ways, but there's a whole other book called Range, which is against this book. But anyway, I read them both in the same summer. It was a lot of fun. But all that said, here's how he starts by dealing with the passion hypothesis. I'm going to read something, but I think it's entertaining enough. He says, in 2002, a research team led by the Canadian psychologist Robert J. Valerand administered an extensive questionnaire to a group of 539 Canadian university students. The questionnaire's prompts were designed to answer two important questions. Do these students have passions? And if so, what are they? All right, so quick thought. A lot of times when you're thinking about anxiety in somebody's life, one of those peak things is about career decisions, right? That is a very anxiety-creating thing. So this is a study on college students who are looking at how is my whole vocational life about to start, right? I ministered with college students for a lot of years, and that question is a major question, right? Choose your major. I don't know what to do. Choose your career. How do you apply for it? So these are major things. So that's who's being asked. And he goes on to say, at the core of the passion hypothesis is the assumption that we all have pre-existing passions waiting to be discovered. The experiment puts that assumption to the test. Here's what it found. 84% of the students surveyed were identified as having a passion, which sounds like good news for supporters of the passion hypothesis. That is, until you dive deeper into the details of these pursuits. Here are the top five passions. Dance, hockey, remember they were Canadian, skiing, reading, and swimming. Though dear to the hearts of the students, these passions don't have much to offer when it comes to choosing a job. In fact, less than 4% of the total identified passions had any relation to work or education, with the remaining 96% describing hobby-style interests such as sports and art. Take a moment to absorb this result. It deals a strong blow to the passion hypothesis. How can we follow our passions if we don't have any relevant passions to follow? At least for these Canadian college students, the vast majority will need a different strategy for choosing their career. Yet how many times do you hear people say, just follow your passion, right? That's what college students are hearing. And then like, well, my passion is to play Ultimate Frisbee. That was me. But the reality is, follow your passion doesn't always work, right? Now, God can give us passions that can correlate to vocation, but that can't be the only determining factor, right? So when I was a senior in high school, I was pretty sure I was going to college. I had been accepted, but I kept getting calls from military recruiters. They just called senior boys all the time. And so I was bored. I didn't have a job at the time. And so I was like, sure, I'll go in. So I went into a place over by Gwinnett Place Mall with an Air Force recruiter. And, I had seen Top Gun, right? It's like, that sounds cool. And so he knows exactly what he's doing. He is showing me Tom Cruise. We got Tom Cruise up here, right? Yeah. So like, that's my dream come true. And so he gives his whole spiel talking about all these amazing things I can do. And if you flip to the next slide, some of you know what that is. That's a colorblind test. I don't see a number on there. I can't be a pilot if I'm colorblind. Also, the tubes in my ears don't work. When I land on a commercial airliner, I've got to put in special earplugs so my eardrums don't burst. I can't be an Air Force pilot. I can't be whatever I want to be. It's just not physically possible for me, right? Yet follow your passions, do whatever you want, be whatever you want to be. It just isn't true. But that puts us in quite a bit of a dissonance, right? For young people, it's like they're watching their dreams crumble because everybody said you follow your dreams and that's the only way it's going to work. And for some of us on the later side of that going, boy, I remember some dreams I had. That never happened, right? And so if that's our only condition for choosing work, then maybe we've been a little bit more influenced by our culture than we mean to be. I love, I've made this up myself. It's not a real thing, but I call it American Idol syndrome. You know, the first few episodes of American Idols where you've got people auditioning and they're horrendous. And then the judges tell them that they're horrendous and like, no, I'm not. And that's when it's like, oh, no. Something is very wrong and your life is going to be hard because it's this absolute blindness to how horrific they are at singing, but they're like, singing is my passion. It's like, well, it doesn't help the world around you when you sing. And it's not actually true, right? And so we've got this disconnect, and American Idol shows it perfectly. I love the way we get around it is by fantasy, right? So the movie Captain America, right, that's the picture of American Dream. How did he get from super scrawny to a superhero? Genetic modification, right? So you can be whatever you want to be as long as they change your DNA and make you big and strong and a superhero, right? That's the only way we can get around it in movies, right? So the reality is maybe this whole be whatever you want to be, do whatever you want to do, follow your passions isn't the best way necessarily to think about things because we might be wrong about it. We might not understand ourselves quite as well as we thought. So, there's also the myth, I'll call it a myth, that you will achieve one great thing in your life. And you'll know when it hits. You'll have this magnum opus moment and realize, boy, that was my life's goal and ambition, and I did it. Some people get that. Most probably don't. And if we aspire to that only, that might leave us disappointed. I love John Piper says it this way. God is always doing 10,000 things in your life, and you may be aware of three of them. God is doing way more through you than maybe you realize. And the achievement of a great dream may not be the main thing that he wants to do through you. He might want to do a lot of things through you. And they might not be unevenly weighted. God is rarely ever only doing one thing at a time. He's doing a lot. Was a big project that you spent 5 years on, did it just tank at the end? Fell before you hit the finish line? Was that work fruitless? I mean, some of your labor was. But who knows what God did in the process, right? He's doing more than just the completion of something. He's doing something in you along the way. Most of history, people didn't have vehicles or airplanes and couldn't travel across the world. Globalization wasn't a thing. The Industrial Revolution hadn't happened for most of history. The way we think about work has changed dramatically in the last 100 years. For the Catholic Church and even the early reformers, there was a doctrine that they called ascriptivism, which basically means the church would look at you changing vocations as a rebellion against God. Based on 1 Corinthians 7 here, the Lord has assigned you work, don't try to get out of it. We know about last names, right? Smith. There's others, right? Sorry, my brain just, baby brain. Baker, yeah. Yeah, so there's names. It's like if your family's a farmer, you're a farmer. And if you leave, it's a kind of betrayal, right? And so for a lot of the history of the world, to change vocations was considered morally wrong. And only recently in world history is this like, choose whatever you want, go wherever you want. That's all new. So the reality is that doesn't mean it's bad, but the reality is it's a different way to think about things. It's still the case in many parts of the world that you do what your family does. When you think about God's assignment in people's lives, a Chinese accountant who shared the gospel with their neighbor and got sent to a labor camp because their neighbor was a spy for the government, have they missed God's call in their life? Or maybe God has a different assignment for them. So what has God called us to? So we saw the word call a lot. I'm going to come back and help us define that assignment thing in a bit, but I wanted to take out some of the assumptions as we got going there. So everywhere that the word call is used in the New Testament as a verb, it's in the past tense. Everywhere that it's used in the New Testament as a verb, it's used in the past tense. That has some pretty significant applications. Your calling in life is not in the future. It's not something yet to be attained. Your calling in life is something that God has already given to you. What kinds of things has God called you to? I've got a few verses here. Romans 1:6, we are called to belong to Jesus Christ. Romans 8:29, we are called according to his purpose. 2 Thessalonians 2:14, we are called to share in the glory of our Lord Jesus Christ. 1 Corinthians 1:9, we are called into fellowship with Jesus Christ our Lord. We're called to be a light in the darkness. We're called to be ambassadors for his kingdom in a lost world. 1 Thessalonians 4:3 through 8, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it starts with this. This is the will of God for you, your sanctification, that you abstain from sexual immorality. And he goes on. So there's some very, very clear callings of God. The primary call that you have on your life is to belong to him. That is the primary call. Most of the time when the New Testament uses the word call as a verb, it's talking about being called to him. It's not talking about your vocation. It's talking about an identity that vocation cannot change. But your vocation may reflect your calling. You have secondary callings, is what I'm going to call them, in relationships, to places, and to vocations. Acts 17:26, it says it this way. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. So he's talking about Adam multiplied, Adam and Eve multiplied. Now there's people everywhere. Having determined, this is what God did, determined allotted periods and boundaries of their dwelling place that they should seek God. So what this is saying is God determined where and when you would live. That's what God has assigned you. He knows when in history you would live. And the boundaries of your dwelling, that means where you'll move and where you'll stay. He already knows. God has assigned that to you. You are called to him and assigned to particular places and relationships and times in the world. Times to be at a certain job, times not to be there. God has done that work. Your family is not a mistake. Your location is not a mistake. Your ethnicity is not a mistake. Your current socioeconomic condition is not a mistake to God. God did not misplace you. Your calling is not just where you go to work. This is from Dan Doriani again. He says, Gene Veith also expands the way we think about work and other roles. Veith identifies several calls beyond work. Believers are called to discipleship, family, society, and the church. A retired woman may not work for pay, but she still has callings as mother, grandmother, citizen, disciple, sister, and friend. A college student has several callings too. He's a student, a roommate, a guard on an intramural basketball team, and a barista at a coffee shop. Given that everyone has several callings, changes are inevitable. But Veith continues, we shouldn't focus on that as if the right calling is around the corner. Society ascribes various weights to these activities, but all have moral value because God issues them. Then verse 21, he's talking about this bondservant thing, right? He says, if you're a bondservant when you're called, it's fine to stay there. But if you get the chance for freedom, avail yourself. Okay, quick side note culturally. In the first century, under Roman rule, there was different kinds of slavery, okay? So Paul's not condoning slavery here. Here's what he's saying. Well, let me just get, so there's three types, just real quick because I'm a nerd. One, a bondservant might be somebody who owes somebody a debt and says, hey, I'll work 2 years to pay it off. And so he literally goes to work for this person. He doesn't get any money for it, but he's probably provided a house and food until he pays off his debt. Number two, you could say, hey, I am just not doing well in the job market, so I'm going to offer myself to you, and I'm going to work in your house. And they get paid, but they technically are under almost a contract like a slave. And then three, there's the horrific, abusive, horrible kind of slavery. All three of those happened in that time frame. I think what Paul is talking to is probably somebody who is a debtor who has given themselves to pay off a debt. But here's what he says. Don't try to get out necessarily, but if you can, you should, right? If there's a better opportunity, you should avail yourself. I think that's probably where the early Catholic Church and even some of the early reformers missed it. John Calvin specifically refuted Martin Luther and said, you missed that parenthetical part of the verse, right? If you have the opportunity for freedom, avail yourself. So it can be good to find change. It's not sinful to find change. But it also can be frustrating if you're always looking for change. All right, so avail yourself of the opportunity. You could come from a really difficult background. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try to get to a different place in life. If you have the opportunity, avail yourself. Or if you're in a bad situation, you might be able to be an agent of redemption in it. I'll kind of machine gun these examples. My brother-in-law, lawyer, had the opportunity to go for partner, but they had four young kids, and he said, I'm not going to get to spend time with my kids. So he didn't go for partner in his law firm. He could have made a lot more money, but he valued something different, right? So he didn't take advantage of the opportunity before him because God had given him something else. I know a guy in my discipleship group right now who decided not to be a manager at his company. He actually stepped out of a managerial position when they had kids. because there's too many off hours, too much off hours work required. I know people who've taken a lower paying job because they have a passion for the work itself. There's the passion hypothesis, sorry. But it's a reality. They said, I can still provide and honor the Lord by taking a much lower paying career to do something that I believe is important for the world and is a blessing. I know somebody who moved to a much higher paying job because it gave him more influence, and he was particularly good at taking organizational tension and turning it to health. So what are the gifts that God has given you? Where can you redeem a situation? Maybe you're in a toxic work environment, but you think, I have the influence and the ability to bring change. If I stay here, I can change something and be a blessing to a lot of people who work here. Or maybe it's not possible, and I've got to leave. I love the question. I was in a class with Dan Doriani, who I've been quoting a lot here. He said, is it okay to work for Pharaoh? As we're hearing for Joseph, which we're going to hear in this next service, if Joseph didn't work for Pharaoh, thousands of people would have died because of a famine. But because Joseph worked for Pharaoh, people were fed and survived, and his family survived. A few hundred years later, Moses is growing up in Pharaoh's household, and Pharaoh is so evil he can't work for him. So he has to leave, right? Same employer. Very different situation, because one could bring redemption. One said, this is too wicked, I've got to get out. Right, so the ethics might be complicated, but can you redeem the situation, or do you need to leave the situation? It's a question to ask. Don't let your dreams about the future ruin where you are today. God has assigned something to you. You can actually enjoy it. Even if he's calling you somewhere else later, we don't have to just be thinking, one day, what if only we can live in contentment. There's going to be other things in your life that happen, other circumstances. That's great, but unless you're engaging in sin or fostering a really broken system in your workplace, you're not outside of God's calling right now. You are where he has you on purpose. You're called where you are. Philippians 4, 11 and 12. Paul says, I'm not speaking of being in need, for I have learned that in whatever situation I am, to be content. Same one who wrote 1 Corinthians 7. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. That's life before the face of God. Every situation I go into, I go in with God. He's not absent in any sphere of my life. He is there in it all. So, we're also just not reminiscing about the past. Maybe you're at the tail end of your career, or you've retired from your career. Your calling isn't over. God still has a very specific calling, many specific callings for your life. He has assigned you to something. There's a time in your life where you can contribute gifts for the blessing of the world, and there's times in your life when you have to learn to be a recipient of the world's gifts to you because you can't anymore. For some, it's health-related at any age. For some, it's as we get older. But it's hard. I have a bad back, and I spent 6 weeks in bed about a year ago because I couldn't move. And my wife had to take care of little kids and me, and it's really hard to receive that gift. It is really hard. So there's a brokenness in the world that our bodies decay and our abilities decay. But God can still use us. And God can still bless us through the work of others, and we can receive that as from the Lord. So, one more Doriani quote here. So then we don't simply choose our vocation. We look for appealing work, and I skipped one. Sorry, go back. Frederick Buchner, I don't know how to say that name. The place God calls you is the place where your deep gladness and the world's hungers are met. If Buchner is right, then our call and work are provisional for the world's hungers shift. We have core abilities and interests that remain through life, but as we grow, our interests and capacities change. As we adjust, our call may change too, especially as we consider the best way to use our skills and restore this broken world. And then this next quote, he says, so then we don't simply choose our vocation. We look for appealing work and hope it is a calling. But we also find our calling by working where we are. Whether we move or not, Whether we can reform our workplace or not, we should think, this is my work, the place the Lord has assigned. So to paraphrase Augustine, when you're thinking about decisions, lay yourself on the altar of God and then do whatever you want. I had a guy named Matt Ballard give me that advice when I was graduating from college. Lay yourself on the altar. Are you pursuing a sinful career? Are you pursuing a career because of sinful desires in you? Maybe that's not a good choice. But aside from that, are you seeking to honor the Lord wherever he might call you? You might not get a sign written in the skies on where you should go next or what you should do, but you can honor him wherever he assigns you. So with that said, I want you just briefly on your own to just write down, what are your current callings in life? There's several. It could be callings as relational in your family. It could be vocational. It could be as a neighbor. Whatever they are, they're simple. Just write down all of the things you're called to, mother, father, sister, brother, husband, whatever it is, parent. Go ahead and write those down. And Ronnie, if you want to come on up. All right. So you have a lot of those. You may be thinking about more. That's okay. Something we're going to do each week for the next four is have somebody kind of share with you their own stories that relates to what we're talking about. So Ronnie is somebody that I've gotten to know over the years, and her story has always been so encouraging to me on how the Lord has worked through her callings and for her callings. So she's going to share for the next 10 minutes, and then I'll come up and conclude.
Thank you, Ryan. I just wanted to share your story because I'm actually a recipient of somebody who did live out their life through the gospel. And just to tell you a little bit about myself, I grew up what I always called in a, rather than a Christ-centered home, a very success-centered home. So when he said, living out your passion, that has always been told to me. I could become anything that I wanted to become. I could do anything that I wanted to do. So success was really important to my brother, sister, and I. And as I came into the work world, I worked in finance, in wealth management, and pretty much started out, though, got some people here, started out at the very bottom as a sales assistant. And by the time I finished my career, I was teaching brokers, basically putting portfolios together in wealth management. I worked for Morgan Stanley. I was vice president there. And I just kind of worked my way up to the top. So in my family, in the eyes of my family, I was just very successful. And so the more success you had, the more it was like the attention you got from my parents. And that's the life that I had lived. I was not a Christian. I met a wonderful man. In fact, I told my parents, I'm from Texas. I told my parents I was going to move here and stay here for 3 years and then eventually come home because this would be the last place that I lived. I lived in England, New Mexico, Florida, different places, and said, I'll be here for 3 years. And I met this wonderful man after 2 years of being here. And as you can see, I'm still here. I never made it back. But we got married. Both of us were not Christian. I had this wonderful marriage. We had two beautiful children. He and his dad owned a business, so we were just, I mean, really living well of what I would call the white picket fence lifestyle. And I loved my job. I loved my children. It just really, sometimes when we think about that calling from God, we think of the times that we're on our knees and we just really are seeking him. But everything in my life was just wonderful according to me, you know, according to what I thought, because I became what I wanted to become. Well, we moved into this subdivision. In fact, we lived in Windermere in South Forsyth, and I had a neighbor who lived right across the street from me who we were, at this point, I had quit my job and decided to stay home to raise my children, which was a hard decision for my husband and I because I loved my job, but I also loved being a mom. So I stayed home for 13 years as a stay-at-home mom, and there was another girl in our neighborhood who lived right across the street from us, and this neighbor had had a lot of stay-at-home moms, so we were all, you know, just being with one another, raising children with one another. But this girl, she lived across the street from me, and she was just so sweet. So if my kids got sick, I can remember one time my whole family got the flu, and she called me from Publix and said, what do you need? And she always had something available for us. She put together play dates. She put together book clubs for us. Just a wonderful person. But what I started to recognize about her life is I looked at her and I saw the way that she parented. And I'm one of those people that, you know, I was raised in a military family, so you parent out of fear, so you do that again, and guess what's going to happen? You know, she parented it out of love. I saw that it looked different for her. Her husband was on the verge of losing his job. I saw the way that they had their trust and faith in God, and they went through it differently. My husband's company, he and his dad, it was starting to pretty much, we weren't making as much. We had to make that decision, do we bail? And that did not look the same as what it looked like for her. And so I could see the way that she served her husband. I served my husband too, but pretty much to get things that I wanted, you know. So it was basically, I could see her life looked attractive to me. I could see her friends come around her and pray with her and love her in hard times. And I wanted that. So she invited me to a Bible study class, and I said, sure, I'd love to, but not because I wanted to learn about Jesus, because I wanted friends like hers. I wanted to be in her social group. And so I went to this Bible study. It was called Breaking Free, and it was actually here at Perimeter Church in 2009. And when I came here, in one of the parts of that study, there's a part that you fill out your name as you read like this prayer. And it said, I can remember it saying, Ronnie, I knew you. I knew your first words, and I'm going to know your last. It said, I suffered with you. And even when you didn't suffer with me. The part that I left out of my story at Morgan Stanley is that as I was working my way up to the top, I got pregnant. I was not married. And I had an abortion. And when I read that part that said, I suffered with you even when you didn't suffer with me, everything came back. How could this God love me? For my past, for what I've done in the past, for the way that I worked my way up to the top, for sometimes, you know, manipulating my way to the top. How could a wonderful God love me? And just wanting to know more about who is Christ. And so then that's where I met Christ. I dove in. I had a wonderful mentor because, you know, I started coming to classes here, and I can remember one of my friends saying, oh, goodness, it's like a kindergartner being in a college class. And my mentor knew, she could see in my face, that's how much she loved me, was she would look at me when I asked, when they would say certain things that I had questions about this. And she said, do you want to meet one-on-one? And so I met one-on-one with her for about 5 to 6 years. And that's where I just really grew and knew who Christ was. And so I really have, let's fast forward, you know, to even last summer, I've always had like this heart for women in crisis. One of the fears that I had also about becoming a Christian was like, okay, here we go. I'm going to have to go door to door and, hey, do you know Jesus Christ? You know, that's what I thought sharing the gospel meant. And that was scary to me because that's not the type of person that I am. And so what I didn't realize was that just the way that the attractiveness of my friend who lived across the street from me, just the way she lived her life, just the way that she poured herself into one person, she was living that gospel life. She didn't go door to door. She built relationships, and she still is. She's moved to Birmingham now, and she's still one person at a time, just loving them and being in relationship with them. And so in my own life, I started joining D groups, because when we look back of like being in relationships, in Genesis 1:26, what does Christ say as he's creating man? He said, let us make them in our image. And so at the us is the Trinity. God has always been in relationship with the Trinity. He's always had a relationship, and he wants us to be in relationships. So being in that relationship in our neighborhood, in our work, in our families is where God has called us to be. And so for my calling, and he also uses our past experiences. So everything prior to Christ, God's going to use that. Romans 8:28. He uses all things for his purpose. And so my experiences where he showed me mercy, I've got those eyes now to be able to see out to other people that were in my situation, other people that lived, you know, that I can be in relationship with. Well, what God had really put in my heart is women who were in crisis, because I've been there. And so last summer, when Roe versus Wade got turned over, I can tell you, I cried and wept, and I was just, this grieving fell upon me, and I didn't know, why am I not celebrating with my fellow Christians? What is it? I know this is a wonderful thing to preserve life. And I couldn't understand it. And one of my mentors had talked with me and said, I think you're grieving the women. I think you know what that feels like to be alone, to be in crisis, to be in it by yourself. And I then thought, okay, this is where we need to, like, the church needs to open up to women and let them know they're loved. So my husband and I discussed it, and we decided that, you know, we are new empty nesters. Our daughter just left for college last August, so we have this home that, you know, lots of empty rooms, and we discussed that we decided that we want to open our home to anyone who needed a place to stay. Being in relationships with one another is really important in a calling, in where God's calling you. Because if you're not knowing people or being able to see this brokenness in our world and be amongst others and building those relationships, sometimes we'll miss those opportunities that God are putting right in front of us. So I belong to a D group, and when my husband and I had decided that we were going to go ahead and open up our home, I kind of got a little excited because, you know, now I'm like an empty nester and thought, if there's a woman in crisis and she's going to move in and I get to hold this little baby and rock it and help her feed it and do some of the mornings, which, you know, any of us who are empty nesters know we miss that part of life. So that's what I thought it was going to look like. And the funny part about it is when we decide that we are looking for that calling or we're looking for opportunities, we have our own agenda. And sometimes God says, no, this is not your agenda. Let me show you what it is. And in my D group, the girls that's in there, one of her really good friends was in crisis. But she was in crisis because she was fleeing from the guy that she had the baby with, who was a four-year-old, and she fled. And the girl in my D group asked me, you know, do you still have that home that's open? And I said, absolutely. Of course, I went to my husband and said, are you ready? And of course, my husband and I, you know, kids just left in August. And so we were like, oh, life is good, you know. And God said, roll up your sleeves, you know, because work's about to begin. And we brought in this girl into our home, beautiful girl. She has a wonderful four-year-old, but the four-year-old did have some problems as far as discipline, but with her, she was ready to do the work with us, and together we worked on this, and she loves that child so much, and my heart opened up. Sometimes where God calls us is not where we think we're supposed to be. It's sometimes going to be a little bit more difficult. I knew this would be difficult. Was I ready for it? No. Did I want to do it? Well, you know. But when God showed me these two people, my heart just opened up. And we loved on them. So that's part of like opening up and knowing where God's going to call you and doing that work for Christ, is being in those relationships that we have with one another. Being able to see. And the thing about it is when God brought her to us and in my whole D group came together, offering her clothing, offering her, like one of the girls had, her mom's a psychologist, opening up and asking her mom, will you be able to do child psychology for free? And she said, absolutely. We all came together. But the part about it is sometimes we think we're Jesus in the situation. And really what she did in the life of my discipleship group, we were able to see Christ at work. And what a gift it is when he allows us to partner in this redeeming work. The part about it is he could do it on his own. He doesn't need us. But the gift is to be able to see it. The gift that I'm seeing in the work that's going on in her life, in her son's life, in our life, in the D group, is just such a beautiful thing. So it's not always in our work. God has brought me into a place to where I do work with one of the authors of the books that they put up there, Tom Nelson, and I am allowed to be able to speak to groups about integrating your faith into work, which means staying at home, with being a mom, being a wife, being a coworker, that's what becoming, like, our work is, and having that gift to be able to integrate that together. So through one individual who showed me love, who was able to just, you know, come around me, and I saw the attractiveness in the fruits that she had, allows me to be able to share this with people of different, you know, actually I work for a ministry called Made to Flourish, so I cover the Southeast region, so I work with different churches within the Southeast region. And so through that one person, it allowed me to learn and grow and share with many. Thank you.
So who knows where God will lead your calling? It's not necessarily something you plan, and it's not necessarily in your job, but it may be. I want us to discuss that in just a second, but looking at the time, I want to close this out here, and I'll leave the discussion up for us to kind of end with. But just a final thought. Envy is very real when it comes to calling. It is very prevalent. We look at somebody else's life, we look at somebody else's job, we look at somebody else's income, and we say, why not me? I want that. This hit me square between the eyes. I was reading a book called The Call by Oz Guinness, and he uses a whole chapter on John 21. And this is after Jesus has raised from the dead, and he's talking to two of his disciples. And it says this, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you're old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." This he said to show what kind of death he was going to glorify God. And after he said this to him, he said, "Follow me." Peter turned and saw the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's John, the author. That's how he referred to himself. Peter turned and saw John following them. And he said, "The one who also has leaned back against him during the supper and said to him,